You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We are a global NGO with research experts in more than 20 countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. Our second series is hosted by Elizabeth Dykstra McCarthy, a former member of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre Natural Resources team, who is now consulting on climate action and environmental issues around the world. Along with several special guests, she'll delve into the social impact of the transition minerals boom, the pitfalls of futuristic methods of mineral extraction, and the capacity of communities to hold companies accountable for abuse, all in search of answers to the question, what is the true cost of clean energy?
The climate crisis is upon us. With it comes the urgent need to decarbonize and transform our economies from those reliant on fossil fuels to greener, cleaner sources of energy. Governments and companies around the world and droves of concerned citizens are driving this transition forward for the good of the planet, its people, and its creatures. But not all people will benefit equally. As the renewable energy transition accelerates, what will the challenges be? Who might the hidden victims be? And what can we do now to make this transition as just as possible?
Does climate cause violent conflict?
Climate change poses a mounting threat to U.S. security, and that it would fuel global tensions, especially in developing countries.
Crisis Group, the International Committee of the Red Cross, UNESCO. These are just a few of the institutions which have begun to link environmental shocks and increasing levels of violence and conflict. Over the past decade, scientists and policy experts have begun to research the ways in which the climate crisis will increase the risk of conflict by exacerbating social, economic, and environmental factors. This is particularly true for the countries and regions most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change itself. But today we ask another question. Will the measures we take to prevent the climate crisis drive conflict itself? In the last episode, we looked at the cobalt supply chain in the DRC, how workers were subject to unsafe conditions and health impacts, how the mines were run on child labor, and about the violence inflicted on artisanal miners. Evidence, too, points towards how these mines have fueled the war economy in the DRC and the armed groups which control it. Let us pause here for a second, though. This conversation might leave us all with the feeling that this is too complicated, too challenging, and too fraught with abuses at the small-scale level. It might lead us to conclude that we should place our hopes in the larger, well-known mining operations whose activities can be monitored and on whom the public eye is well-trained. But that isn't where the evidence lies either.
Now, if you look at most people's idea of what bad mining is, they almost instantly move towards looking at small-scale miners, for instance, in the Congo with the various human rights abuses, child labour, etc. That clearly that is an issue and clearly that is a problem. But it's interesting that that's where people's first thoughts go to and not, for instance, you know, the greater impacts that can come from the environmental and indeed human rights abuses that come from some really phenomenally large-scale mines.
Speaking now is Andrew Whitmore, the co-chair of the London Mining Network, an alliance of development and environmental groups who work with the human rights and sustainable development communities around the world affected by the activities of mining companies based in or funded from London.
A lot of my experience comes from the Philippines, and there, you know, there's very often small-scale mining that I've seen that's in a very very positive light. So, for instance, there's small-scale mining that's done on indigenous land, indigenous people themselves, frequently done by women, controlled by women, frequently done to substitute sort of agricultural side of living. So, you know, when people aren't working in the fields, then they'll move to small-scale mining and move again. It works, I think, because it works within these tribal societies that have rules going back through generations in terms of who owns what and what can be done.
Andy spent much of his career working in Asia, particularly on issues of conflict and extractives.
I mean, I would say that there really is direct correlation between many of the so-called transition minerals, you know, the minerals that are going to be required for the energy transition, and increased human rights abuses, increased conflict. Some of the most obvious examples are around cobalt in the Congo. And clearly, you know, there has been well-documented and well-mapped situations in terms of the situation with, particularly with small-scale miners, but also with communities there.
We discussed violence surrounding cobalt in the Congo in the last episode, the violence perpetrated by private security forces on unregulated labour or violence towards child labourers. So is the problem with these small unregulated sectors, the artisanal small-scale mining sector, rather than these larger companies which have human rights policies in place and can be held to account by international and national pressure? Historically, policymakers have tended to agree, designing policies to stamp out artisanal mining due to all the abuses we have discussed. But not everybody agrees.
I think, you know, it's important to say that small-scale mining, it really is a case of it can be done better. And when it's done better, it certainly provides more employment, more steady income for communities, etc., than the options for large-scale mining, where you tend to have fewer people actually employed who are often brought in as experts from outside the community.
So how should we tackle these issues, from health and safety to corruption, violence to child labour?
The most important thing, I think, is the national level. You know, there really needs to be more done to ensure that proper regulation is brought in of small-scale miners. And part of that regulation is also about supporting local communities and making sure that the miners not only ensure that they have, you know, equipment, etc., but that the areas that they're mining are clearly laid out and that the potential impacts from any mining is also considered.
Andy has mentioned his work in the Philippines with small-scale miners. But to discuss how violence can be linked to a large-scale project, let us turn now to another project he was closely involved in, the epitome of a large-scale project. This is the story of a foreign company exploiting massive reserves with high-profile government contracts, the Grasberg copper mine in Indonesia.
It tends not to be considered that much of a transition mineral, and yet copper is absolutely essential for some of the hardware, but particularly for electrical transmission. So clearly, if we're going to be electrifying fleets of vehicles and ensuring that there's better battery storage, etc., then, you know, we're going to need a lot more copper wire to be running across grids. Copper, partly because it's mined these days at from such low grades and at such large scale across the world, everywhere from Peru and Chile. You know, an example I would use is the Grasberg mine in West Papua in Indonesia.
That is the largest gold and copper mine in the world. There are few mineral resources as big as Grasberg. It is literally a mountain of copper and gold.
Hundreds of Ikari tribesmen carrying bows and arrows blocked an access road near the Freeport mine site. Journalists are barred from entering Irinjaya by the Indonesian government. Just how volatile the situation remains in this remote part of the world.
The human rights abuses at the Grasberg copper mine in West Papua are perhaps one of the most well-publicized human rights allegations from mining operations around the world. One of the world's richest mining operations, with perhaps the third largest reserves of copper in the world, there has been prospecting in Indonesia's easternmost province, Irinjaya, also known as West Papua, since the 1960s.
It is one of the world's biggest mines, and that's in an area that is controlled by Indonesia, but has a large Papuan population who are looking for independence.
Two principal indigenous communities live in the region, the Emungme and the Kamoro, as well as almost 100,000 migrants from across the island and Indonesia. The Emungme have lived in this rainforest for over 30,000 years, and peaceful resistance from the Emungme has been recorded since the establishment of the mine in 1967, when it became clear these work crews were there to stay. The mine has been dumping the waste from its mills, almost 200,000 tons of tailing waste every day, into the Agabagong River, which disgorges into the Ajikwa River and thence into the Arafura Sea, almost four times the amount of mine waste produced from the next largest mine on the island, Oktedi.
And, you know, there's been fantastic amounts of environmental impact. About 280,000 tons of waste has been poured directly into the local river system for around half a century. Then also human rights abuses in the local Hmong population, which has led to huge militarization in the area. But you look at something like that and you consider costs, and that's such a little known conflict, because it's in an area of the world that's far away for most people.
Little to no negotiation took place with the Emungme for the acquisition of their land and compensation for their dwellings and livelihood, for which the government paid them in tobacco and goods. The first recorded agreement was in 1974, negotiated between the company, the government, and the Emungme community leaders, but it was riddled with controversy and allegations that the negotiations were held in Indonesian, to which the Emungme could not have adequately consented, and that military officials there had pressured the Emungme into accepting these terms. Since then, the violence has increased. Riots in 1976, an uprising in 1977, followed by an airborne response by the Indonesian military, razing the village and killing 30. In the conflict that followed, the indigenous resistance was joined by the Free Papua Independence Movement, Organisasi Papua Merdeka, or OPM, a movement that breathes life still today.
A secret war. West Papuan activists are fighting for independence from Indonesia like never before.
This has catalysed a conflict with the rebel movement and indigenous groups on one side, the state and the mining operation on the other, and a litany of human rights abuses. For all the violence perpetrated because of artisanal mining, this blows it out of the water.
And yet is also being done by large multinational companies that are, in the case of Grasberg, it's run by Freeport-McMoRan, which is a US-based company, and had a one-fifth ownership from Rio Tinto, a UK-based company. These are not small companies that are, you know, you could dismiss as just having a bad reputation from not having enough money to deal with the environmental, social governance issues. You know, these are big multinationals.
Freeport Indonesia currently holds a contract for the Grasberg area of around 5 million acres, a 50-year contract that won't expire until 2041. Freeport is one of the largest corporate taxpayers on the island and is a status symbol as the first foreign investment in the country and has thus been declared a national asset. This has made the relationship between the private mining operation and the state particularly close and particularly complicated. Consequently, the extent to which the state is prepared to defend its interest in the mine is crucial, and there have been as many as 1,800 troops in the area, including a unit whose sole purpose was the defense of the mine.
My name is Nemankawi, the White Arrow. My name is not gold or copper. Say it like it is.
Yusefa Longmang is the matriarch amongst the Emungme. Known affectionately as Mama Yusefa, she has advocated for the rights of her people for decades and survived the conflicts of the 80s and 90s as she protested against Freeport and the Indonesian government. Despite this inhumane confinement and torture, she has fought for traditional culture, collective action, and the rights of indigenous peoples. In 2001, she won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize, the foremost prize for grassroots environmental activists.
My name is Yusefa Lomang. I'm among me. We are from Timika, and Nemankawi is our land. Now I'm old. I feel like I've lost everything. The Republic of Indonesia kills people like me, among me people. The land the military owns in Timika wasn't bought. It was taken at gunpoint.
This is an excerpt from an interview she gave in 2014. Yusefa's story is harrowing. Multiple international NGOs and civil society organizations have highlighted the human rights abuses perpetrated by the Indonesian military and their links to the Grasberg mine.
The Indonesian military is used as a tool, as a weapon to kill us. Freeport spends its money to give to the military.
Yusefa narrates the Emungme perspective of how the mine was first established and how the military were involved. Like Jesse described earlier, this conflict begins with land rights and indigenous rights and then escalates into persecution by state and security forces, environmental damage leading to widespread health impacts and increased mortality, as well as extrajudicial killings.
Tujuh itu, saya pikir, In 1977, the military came to Wakiburu. I asked my father what kind of people they were. My father, Paulus Magal, said, "Children, tomorrow they will eat us. Murderers." I asked, "Why will they murder us?" He said, "So that they can secure Tanika. That's why they came. The military weren't there to secure Freeport. They were there to secure us. They came in their green uniforms into the houses. They took all the men from the houses in 1977. They created our Papuan fighting spirit in that year, 1977.
Once the OPM resistance movement had begun to establish a base in the Wawa Valley alongside the Emungme, who had already been resisting the mine and state for over a decade, attacks began against the Freeport mining installations. In response, the army extracted a heavy toll. Counter-guerrilla warfare led to the bombing of local areas, the destruction of villages, the killing of thousands of civilians. In the 2 decades that followed, the Emungme were forced to repeatedly flee into the forest for years at a time. But it was not just that the land had been taken, but that the land that remained was toxic.
I lived in Tamika since 1973. I had children a long time ago. All my children were born there. And my first child died because of tailing sickness. I heard the doctor say it. Now I have found out that it is the water that carries the sickness. None of us people from Tamika are healthy. There is sickness in our bodies. Before we didn't get it. But now we just wash in the water and get sick or eat food from there. We die on our own land for the mining interests of Indonesia and America.
Nor was the land livable. The crops on which they used to live were unable to grow with the water and soil contamination in the ecosystem. But opposition was worse than fruitless. It was lethal.
Who would speak to them? Who was brave enough to oppose the soldiers? Of course nobody would. The military didn't come to Tamika to fight the OPM guerrillas, or against corruption or Freeport, but indigenous people in our land. They said, "They're OPM, so we kill them. Just be silent." They terrorized us with guns, with their bullets around them like this, traumatizing the women, taking their husbands to be killed and disappearing, thrown away to sea, arrested.
The line between state and private security became increasingly unclear. According to a report by Global Witness, the killing of a Papuan employee of Freeport in October 1994 by unknown gunmen led to a military crackdown in the area. Over 6 months, as many as 37 Papuans were killed by troops or disappeared.
During the protests that followed, clashes with the Indonesian troops led to the death of 2 more tribesmen, adding to the growing anger and resentment felt toward the American-owned company.
Freeport, Indonesia's private security guards were accused by human rights activists of complicity in killings, torture and other abuses. And it gets even murkier. In August 2002, 3 Freeport employees were gunned down in an ambush. The New York Times has repeated claims made that these killings may have been carried out by soldiers in the military to ensure the continuation of paid security arrangements, as initially suspected by the police. Forced to disclose its financial ties to the military, the company has since admitted that its total spending on the military and police had topped $66 million by the end of 2005.
Who wants this kind of security? When we went to the garden, the military came with weapons, taking people's wood, taking people's vegetables. They came in and threatened us with their weapons. It wasn't Freeport they were securing. It was us they were securing with their guns. I said I'd kill myself to make a stand. 50 of my women members died opposing them during the 80s. The military would harass the men who were strong in the family. Take their wood, take their chickens, their gardens and vegetables. That's why we cried. The women were scared. They disappeared their men. They were asking, "Where is my husband? Where is my child?" Raping and murdering from the 80s to the 90s.
These brutalities did not end in the 80s and 90s. There are no official estimates, but there are an estimated 100,000 to 500,000 West Papuan deaths as a result of this conflict. Whilst the mine was by no means the sole cause of the civil war and guerrilla combat, it nonetheless set the spark and fueled the fire throughout the following century, to the anguish and cost of the indigenous peoples.
They would say to me, "They're OPM, not a human." That is what they accused me of. In 1994, I was held in a military prison for 1 month. They held me in a sewer and threw food in the sewer. 15 of us went into that prison. 5 were disappeared.
This isn't an individual example. Mining operations have been connected to the prolonging of civil wars, to the abuses of state security sectors, and to the worsening of conflict and unrest from here to Peru. This is not to say that the opening of every copper mine will lead to outright warfare, but it has led to armed attacks, the deployment of the military, government declarations of emergency and martial law. The demand for copper and each of these transition minerals is only projected to rise. There is no reason to believe this violence will fade away, and many reasons to believe it will continue.
Freeport is finishing off the Papuan people. The Papuans are disappearing, murdered in all kinds of ways. And now my mountain region, there are no people left there.
This story stands in opposition to the narrative often told about violence around mining operations, that by reducing artisanal small-scale operations, we can reduce the harm caused. In fact, the devastation wreaked by a well-funded transnational company operating alongside a state-sanctioned use of force was total and unimaginable. This tracks with the findings from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre.
So while we look at six minerals and we see it as a snapshot, the companies that are most present within the tracker, because 18 companies make up 80% of the allegations, are Western, European, American companies that would be almost household names.
You might remember Jesse Cato from episode 1, the natural resources manager at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center, who led a project, the Transition Mineral Tracker. Her team collected and analyzed the human rights allegations from six minerals mined for renewable energy technologies across the world. As she notes here, one in every 5 allegations was directed at a company you will likely already have heard of, the Rio Tintos, the Glencores, the BH Billitons of this world.
These are not allegations being driven by small or medium-sized companies. They're not allegations being driven solely by Chinese-owned and operated companies. These are Western companies. And so I think it's really important when talking about what's the responsibility of big companies. The first step is still with the big companies. They're still responsible for a significant number of human rights violations, both at the parent level and through their subsidiaries. It is still very much appropriate to make those big companies responsible and accountable because their own operations are not operating in a way that respects human rights.
So first of all, get the big players, the known players, who are most responsible for the production and concomitant allegations of these commodities. Secondly, it causes us to reevaluate our approach to ASM.
The extractive sector is local, but it is always global. You cannot remove artisanal and small-scale mining from the global economy. It supplies a significant amount of materials needed into formal markets. And people know that this happens. It operates on its own informal economy, and it is a major employer in a lot of countries. Reducing or cracking down on artisanal and small-scale mining would not only have global supply chain effects, but would significantly harm a lot of people's livelihoods. What we do need is some formalization of the sector. And again, we need different standards of operations coming from companies that are around artisanal and small-scale mining spaces. Where we see conflict from the tracker, at least, is around security forces that, quote unquote, we don't know who they belong to, coming in and creating violence and conflict within artisanal and small-scale projects. And so we know that there are ways that governments and companies are pushing back on this to create more conflict, to try and occasionally damage the sector and put responsibilities onto the sector for issues that we feel that they are not necessarily responsible for.
However, it is one thing to say that the responsibility and accountability lies with these major producers, Glencore and Anglo American, Vedanta and Rio Tinto, and quite another to bring major changes to those companies.
The issue is not with policy implementation, it's with policy enforcement. And so we need to see governments actually upholding the standards that they have set for companies, because otherwise, if there is no consequence to breaking those laws and regulations, then why would companies continue to work within them? Governments have a significant responsibility in setting the standards in which companies are allowed to operate.
Enforcement can be challenging in any context, but even more complex for multinational companies, headquartered in Canada but operating in Peru, where domestic regulations around how extractive companies operate may be in place, but weakly administered and enforced.
But I think one of the most important parts of that reform is that it does actually have financial consequences for companies that are not meeting these due diligence requirements. And I think that has certainly been a challenge within the sector for a long time. Too often, companies' governance or, you know, good practice is contingent on voluntary measures, and that there isn't actually mandatory requirements and consequences where they choose not to meet those. And so that, I think, is going to be a shift in company practice, but a shift also in putting responsibility at the company's feet and making them accountable.
So what kind of policies might make that happen?
I think the good thing with the EU mandatory human rights due diligence legislation that does have teeth, and it is enforceable within the countries where the companies are listed and headquartered. I certainly think that we are seeing a growing amount of legislative action occur from civil society and from communities, trying different avenues to seek remediation and compensation through European court systems.
In fact, that is exactly what we'll be looking at in the next episode. Communities taking action by bringing their cases to the European systems, where rule of law has a stronger track record in addressing their grievances. A stronger track record, but certainly not infallible. This brings us back to enforcement. There are quite a few mechanisms in place to increase transparency or accountability on the fiscal parts of extraction, which had previously been largely voluntary, until the EU accounting and transparency directives and the Canadian Estima law, which made reporting of payments to governments mandatory for extractive companies. Without mandatory measures, it is easy to take advantage of the system.
I think it was quite easy for companies to say that they had met requirements or not participate in a way that was genuine, not undertake consultation that was legitimate, and get away with it. Because if the consequence of not participating properly is outweighed by the reputational assistance you get from taking part in some of these voluntary mechanisms, there isn't really a lot of incentive for companies to shift how they're behaving. And so this approach for the due diligence, I think, is not only useful in terms of being able to increase the level of accountability, but it is necessary given how we have seen a large part of the sector engage with some of these different mechanisms before.
Getting away with it often feels like it might be the mission objective for these companies, at least if you're the advocates working on the other side of these issues. The response to human rights allegations is often a series of denials and defences, and very rarely leads to systemic change, which is something we'll be looking at next. Instead, the need for minerals as part of the renewable energy transition can be used by companies as a veneer for their operations, arguing that they too are a critical part of the green transition, downplaying the cost of how these minerals are mined.
I think this is a huge, huge issue, the issue of greenwashing. Is really becoming prevalent.
For this, let's go back to Andy Whitmore, who opened the episode with his work in Indonesia, championing community rights.
I mean, having worked on the industry now for a couple of decades, I think what's interesting to me is that when I started, we were in a position where we were really struggling to hold companies to account. And then I think what shifted over a couple of decades is that there has been some improvements, definitely, but I think the major improvement probably is that they now write really long reports that say all the work they do and how they hold themselves to these various standards, etc. I think what that's done for us is to shift the direction of what we're doing to looking very much at trying to hold them to the account in terms of the reports.
Is it possible for companies who have historically been enmeshed in some of the world's worst human rights abuses to become champions of the renewable energy transition? What would it take for them to do so, and should we believe it if they say it? The answers to these questions rest on much more than PR spin and well-worded human rights policies. It rests on how private companies take action, whether communities are consulted, how Indigenous rights are protected, whether abuses are reported and taken to the state. And of course, this goes beyond private companies to their relationship with the state, who must also hold these companies accountable when these abuses are uncovered. For many Indigenous peoples and local communities, the danger comes not just from the private corporations, but from the government itself, whose abdication of responsibility is perilous, but its active engagement in the seizure of land and resources can be deadly. Today, we touched on how hard it is for companies to be held accountable by the government. In the next episode, we will look at whether and how that is changing, and if retribution is due.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay up to date with all the latest news from us, you can follow us on Twitter at BHRRC or search for Business and Human Rights Resource Centre on LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe to This Way Up wherever you get your podcasts. Keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share with your networks.